The Guardian.
During April, The Guardian's podcasts are partnering with audible.co.uk. Audible has over 60,000 digital audiobooks and are offering Guardian podcast listeners one for free. Visit guardian.co.uk/audible to find out more.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Cha. On the show this week...
And if I want to whistle that, I can say... And if I want to hum it...
If you're one of the Pirahá tribe in the Brazilian Amazonian basin, you'll not only know what's just been said there, you'll recognise the voice of linguist and author Daniel Everett. He'll be discussing his latest book on the role of language in human societies.
And even cranes to make them move, because you would not be able to move even an elephant's leg just by manpower.
Easter bunnies should probably stay away from the Natural History Museum for the time being. This week sees the opening of the latest exhibition from Gunter van Hagens, a spectacle of plastinated taxidermy. And also, we'll take you through this week's science stories, including why the US authorities are nervous about two papers exploring genetically modified strains of influenza, and the discovery in South Africa of the ancient human desire to barbecue. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. One of the hottest debates in linguistics for some time has related to something very basic. Are humans born with language, or do we learn it? Is it hardwired into our brains, or do our brains adapt and develop this capacity as we grow? An intriguing contribution to this debate comes from Daniel Everett. He's a professor of linguistics and the Dean of Arts and Sciences at Bentley University. Decades of studying a small tribe called the Pirahá in the Amazonian basin has led him to believe that humans are not born with language. This idea goes against the so-called universal grammar principle, associated most strongly with the ideas of the linguist Noam Chomsky. Everett's latest book is Cognitive Fire, Language as a Cultural Tool. Guardian science correspondent Ian Sample met up with the professor to learn more. Ian started by asking Professor Everett to explain what drew him to languages and the culture of the Pirahá tribe.
I went to the Amazon originally as a missionary to translate the Bible for a group of people called the Pirahá.
Can you help us picture the Pirahá? What are they like? What is the environment they live in like? Just help us with that.
They live in the stereotypical view we would have of the jungle, very thick jungle around them and a beautiful river running by their villages. They always live close to the river. They hunt and gather fish. And spend the bulk of their time, since hunting and gathering and fishing is relatively easy for them, the bulk of their time is spent in the village talking with one another.
And what do you find that's interesting about their culture, and importantly, how do you think that shaped their language?
Their culture is fascinating because they have what I have termed an immediacy of experience principle, which means that they talk about things that are going on right now or things that they have seen in their own lives or other people who are still alive have told them about. That means they don't talk about the distant past. They have no creation myths. They don't talk about the distant future, like where will the Pirahá be in 100 years. They focus on now. That also has the implication that they don't think a lot about regrets that they had or worry about the future.
You went out there as a missionary, but you have focused on the linguistics. How did that come about?
Well, I initially went to translate the Bible, and that made me very interested in language, obviously, and in their language in particular. But I eventually lost my faith among the Pirahá because they asked me for the kinds of evidence that I had for my faith. And when I realized what I had gone there for, one of the major reasons was to help them lead a better life as Christians, and I realized there was no way to improve their life from my perspective, and from their perspective either. They saw themselves as very happy and very content and self-sufficient.
So what do you think can be learned by studying their language?
Their language has a great deal to teach us about a number of things. For example, they're the only language known in the world that doesn't have any numbers or concept of counting. They're the only language known that has no creation myths. They have the simplest kinship system known. They have no words for color. They describe colors. They can see colors, but they have no words for colors. And they lack a principal part of grammar that linguists such as Noam Chomsky have claimed to be vital to humans to develop languages in the first place, something that Chomsky calls recursion.
Your book, Language, the Cultural Tool, it does challenge some of these common theories. Can you just set those out and how your ideas really differ from those?
Yeah, the principal idea of the major theory of language that we have today is called universal grammar, or as Steven Pinker refers to it, the language instinct, that humans are born with a language structure innately wired into them through their genes. My book sets out the alternative perspective that although it's true that only humans can learn language, this is because a number of general characteristics that humans have. And one of the most important characteristics of human beings that enables language is culture. Sharing values, the need to communicate, and language is the tool that humans have invented to establish community.
And if you're right about that, as opposed to something, an idea is put forward like Pinker and so on, what are the broader implications? Are there broader implications than that?
There are broader implications because they tell us that the fundamental similarity between human beings is not our genetic structure per se, although we certainly share genetic structure, but it's the fluidity and the flexibility of humans to adapt to local environments. Human beings have fewer genes than plants like corn, which means that, among other things, we are less formed by our genes than by our genes allowing us to have general intelligence and general properties that enable us to solve problems in a range of environments. To me, that is really what's at issue here. Are human beings structured in their mental characteristics by some genetic program, or is there a great deal of flexibility built into the human mind that enables us to build different kinds of languages, different kinds of cultures, and different kinds of experiences in the world?
How do you go about building up your evidence for this argument? What are your methodologies in the field?
In the book, the first part of the book, it takes the standard, apart from field experience, it takes the standard arguments that have been given for universal grammar, and it dissects those and it rejects those. And then it starts by building a new model by looking at a variety of languages and how each of those languages has a different culture that affects the structure of their language and produces some effects that we wouldn't have ever otherwise thought possible.
Can you give us some examples of the language, I mean, that maybe highlight some of these issues that you're talking about?
Well, the Pidha language is fascinating because it can be whistled, hummed. It can be communicated in other ways besides consonants and vowels. It's not the only language that can be whistled or hummed, but it's one of the few languages that has all of these together. So if I say there is a large rodent over there with consonants and vowels, I will say kai, au, aga, kai. And if I want to whistle that, I can say, and if I want to hum it, and all of those are equivalent to a Pidha. They understand them all just fine, and they each have a separate function within the culture.
They sound the same, though. Those three versions of doing it, when you whistle it and you hum it and you speak it, you're following the same melody, if you
That's
like.
Exactly right. Because
that's what they're recognizing.
That's what they recognize. They recognize the rhythm of the words, the inherent pitches on the vowels of each word, because it's a tone language like Chinese, and they recognize the accent pattern of each word. So once you can communicate that, the consonants and vowels aren't as important. That's another reason I believe they have the smallest number of consonants and vowels. They're tied with Hawaiian and Rhodocos, with only three vowels and eight consonants for men and three vowels and seven consonants for women, so that they even make a distinction culturally between the way women speak and the way men speak.
You must hit some enormous barriers when you turn up in the Amazon with Bible under hand, with the language that you grew up with, and you immerse yourself with these people. Tell me about some of the, you must have had some interesting sort of misinterpretations or confusions with these people in the past.
Well, I mean, there are a number of things. They don't like to talk about things they don't have evidence for. So as I was telling them about Jesus, somebody came in and said, Dan, Jesus, was he brown like us or was he white like you? And I said, Well, some people say he was brown and some people say he was white. And they said, but you must have seen him. I said, I didn't see him. Well, your father, what did your father say? I said, my father didn't see him either. And they said, well, then why are you telling us about him? Because no one I had ever known had seen him. When I did finish translating the Gospel of Mark, they played it on these hand crank recorders, and they listened to it very intently. And the lesson they took away from that they just kept listening to over and over, was the beheading of John the Baptist. They found that very interesting. The rest of it, they didn't really pay much attention to, after all.
If they don't have numbers, they don't have they don't speak about future times and past times in particular.
Right.
How do you tell them, for instance, I'll see you in 6 months?
I tell them, I'll see you when the water reaches this point on the bank. And they know the water has a yearly cycle, and they can calculate by that.
This debate over whether language is innate or something else gets very heated. Why is that?
Well, it gets heated for a couple of reasons. First is the good reason that we're all interested in understanding the nature of human beings. And this has a lot rides in the balance here, because are human beings primarily inflexible or flexible? And that's part. So are we designed to speak in a certain way, or can we speak in other ways? And the other part of it is just the sociology of science. A number of scientists have staked their careers on the idea that language is innate, and another group of scientists believes that it's not innate. And so whenever you come out with a strong thesis like that, you're sure to offend people. So regularly I'm getting hate mail from one side and support and praise from the other side. But really all I'm trying to do in the book is lay out what I consider to be the results of my research and the conclusions that these have led me to.
Do you dismiss the universal grammar issue as an artifact, just that we've developed language for similar reasons? So our tools look the same, as if you were looking to dig the ground, our tools might look the same.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if you want to kill protein that moves faster than you, the bow and arrow is a great solution. And every culture, let's say every culture in the world has a bow and arrow, that does not mean that we need to have an innately specified bow and arrow grammar in our brains. It's just a good solution to that problem.
Is there work that you'd like to see done now to try and clarify this issue? And I don't know how wedded to your own argument you are.
I think, I have given a lot of the data that I've collected over the years and that the missionary who preceded me collected to scientists at Tufts University and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology to conduct independent tests on this. The Tufts University scientists have already written a paper that is going to be published soon, in which they say that they've corroborated my results. The MIT scientists still have studies ongoing about this. So certainly, the ideal thing would be to take a group of people to the Pidaha and do design experiments and run experiments there, but that's difficult for a number of reasons, but we're still hoping to do that within the next year or so.
Are the Pidaha interested in your language when you're out there? Do they ask you questions about it, and what do they make of it?
Oh, they're fascinated by it. So we're out in the jungle, and they'll point to something and say, Dan, how do you say this in your language? I'll say, tree. How do you say that? Tree. How do you say that? Tree. So you just have one word? Well, that's the only word I know for all those things. So they say, well, your language can't say very much. So then sometimes they'll just say tree. Gee, that's an ugly way to say it. So they're fairly convinced that they speak a very beautiful language.
So do they have more precision for what is within their particular environment then? Do they use sort of location, or they have a richer phraseology or something?
They have not only a mental map. Every Pidaha man, woman, and child has a mental map of their area. So they won't say go to the fourth tree because they don't have numbers, but they know what the names of places are in the jungle, and they'll meet each other just fine by saying go to this place. Every Pidaha also knows that what we would call the species name of every plant and animal they encounter, and they know all about the plants. They know all about the animals that grow in the plants. They know all their uses. It's an astounding knowledge of nature, and I don't have anything like it even in my hometown. I don't know the trees in the back of my house half as well as the Pidaha know trees anywhere in the jungle.
You talk in your book about this issue that some people seem to fear that by talking about different complexities of language, that that might infer, be used to infer something about the people themselves. So a less complex language might be seen to infer that the people themselves are not as advanced and such. Like, I wondered if you could talk about that issue and your thoughts on it.
Yeah, I mean, the simplest answer is that if language is a tool, we're going to develop it the way that fits best for our environment. So if a language lacks recursion, that's no more a sign of inferiority than the fact that I lack golf clubs because I don't play golf, so I don't need them. It's also the fact that it's difficult to evaluate how complex a language is. So the Pidha have a relatively simple syntax with putting sentences together, but they have a very complex word structure. So in English, each word has only five forms: sing, sang, sung, singing, sings. And in Spanish or Portuguese, maybe 40 forms for each verb. But in Pidha, each verb has over 65,000 possible forms. They're incredibly complex verb structure. So the fact that they're simple in one area doesn't mean they're simple in all areas. Then there's also the Pidha are able to, when they tell stories, that you see a lot of complex reasoning in their stories. When Pidha children have been kidnapped, which I know of cases of, and raised outside the village, they speak perfect Portuguese and do math just fine. So there's nothing here about cognitive simplicity or any characteristics that they have that makes them inferior to us. They've just chosen to live their lives in a certain way, and they have adopted the linguistic tools they need to do that.
How big a community are they?
The population has grown considerably in the last 5 or 6 years, so they're up to about 750 people. From when I started working there 35 years ago, it was probably about 110 people.
And these are all within walking distance of each other?
No, they're scattered over a river called the Maisi River that's over 300 miles long. And so some villages can be walked to one from another, but others take a 10-day canoe trip, for example.
What's next for you with this? Are you doing more research in this area, or are you going back to the Pidha?
The goal is to go back to the Pidha to do a number of other kinds of research following up on this, and also other indigenous groups. I would actually prefer, I have several anthropologists who would like me to come with them to work with other hunter-gatherers and societies to see how well this generalizes and what we can find out about those languages from people, from anthropologists who already know the cultures extremely well.
Do you think this argument over whether language is innate or not is ever going to be settled?
I think it will be. I think that, not to use an analogy that's inappropriate, but I think, Freud had an enormous influence in the study of the mind and psychology. And at one time, it was the absolute dominant paradigm of psychology, psychoanalysis, and then it moved on, and there was a period of controversy. And nowadays, Freud is important, but still a relative footnote to the study of psychology as it's done today, and I suspect that that's going to be the fate of universal grammar.
How long do you think it'll take?
It'll take a few years, but the biggest force for universal grammar is Noam Chomsky, although there are others, and it's difficult to predict how long that will last, but I think that the majority of linguists in the world today are finding that idea less and less convincing.
Thanks very much, Daniel.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's that time of the program to look at the big science news stories of the week. To do that, I'm joined by Ian Sample and by The Observer's science and technology editor, Robin McKee. Welcome to you both, gentlemen. Ian, now you wrote a story about a controversial set of scientific papers. It's a debate going on across the Atlantic about whether scientists should be allowed to publish the genetic sequences of mutant forms of influenza. Take us through a bit of the background and what happened last week.
Okay, so there are two groups, one at Erasmus Medical Center in Rotterdam and one at University of Wisconsin, Madison, who had papers that described work on mutant or hybrid forms of bird flu that showed that you could create a virus in the lab that was easily transmissible between mammals, in this case ferrets, which are the sort of the animal model for looking at how well a virus will transmit between humans. Now, what happened was those papers, the study from the Dutch group led by Ron Fouché, he essentially mutated H5N1, the bird flu virus, and had a paper ready in Science to publish when a US biosecurity board saw the paper and said, we don't think you should publish this because it might get into the hands of a rogue state or bioterrorist. The other paper from a guy called Yoshihiro Kawaoka at University of Wisconsin in Madison, he had done something very different. He had merged H5N1 bird flu with the swine flu pandemic strain from 2009 and found some other mutations that helped these viruses go airborne, as they say. Basically, both viruses could infect animals and be caught between animals living in adjacent cages. It didn't kill them. But anyway, this biosecurity panel, first of all, said you can't publish these studies. And then they looked at revised versions earlier this month and said, OK, you can go ahead with those versions.
So, again, just for background, people who maybe aren't familiar with it, the mutations that these research groups put into these viruses allowed them to transmit between mammals, as you say. In nature, these things, H5N1, H1N1, these particular strains were not transmitting between people, which is why even though they're dangerous if you catch them, the fact that they don't transmit between each other means that the pandemic types of level situation hasn't happened so far. But this is what we're worried about, right? This is what scientists are worried about. At some point in nature, these mutations will happen. So why did they do them in the first place?
Well, that's exactly the question that they're looking to answer. These experiments, both of them, were aimed at understanding and answering the question, does avian flu in the wild have the capability of mutating into a form and adapting to a form that would spread really quickly through coughs and sneezes in people? You do those experiments in the lab, and both of these teams show that with a pretty small number of mutations, you can get the virus to transmit in an animal model, in ferrets, but that's the mimic that's used for humans.
And is the idea that then you create this mutant form with a view to creating vaccines or studying it further? Is that the idea?
Well, one of the things you can do is when you've identified the genes, the mutations that are important for helping the virus to spread between mammals, you then understand what those mutations do, how they alter the virus. And then you go to the surveillance teams. You know, there are surveillance teams out in Southeast Asia and wherever, looking in poultry flocks, looking in people to look for those mutations arising. Now, to look for the specific mutations that both of these teams found is one strategy, and you would probably do that. But what you're really more interested in is just finding out generally what those mutations do and look for any that cause the virus to develop in that way, because you know that once you get to a critical number, you have a potentially dangerous pandemic strain on your hands.
So going back to these labs and the sequences, the danger, of course, is that if you publish them for everyone to see, someone could assemble these viruses and perhaps get them out there, or these things could escape from labs as they're being created for scientific research purposes. What's the latest thinking by the US authorities on this then?
Well, the biosecurity panel had reconvened a meeting where they got to see revised versions of both papers, and essentially what those papers contained, apparently nothing was deleted from those papers. Both authors say nothing was removed from those papers, but additional data was added and some clarifications were made that showed how transmissible the viruses are. They're not very transmissible, actually. They're nowhere near as transmissible as seasonal flu is in people. How dangerous they are, again, the answer is not particularly. None of the animals were killed when they caught it over through the air from another animal. You really have to load up the animal with millions of viruses and put it right into the trachea to get any deaths, especially that's in the case of Fouchier's work, the Dutch work. And the studies also show that both of those viruses can be trialled by existing vaccines and antiviral drugs like Tamiflu.
Robin, this whole escapade for very many months now sort of lays bare some of the scientific process and how governments and review boards and journals sort of all operate together. The big question at the back of it all is, if these government agencies in the US had prevented these sequences from being published, you're talking about scientific censorship, which is something that scientists, you know, rightly balk against. But what's your thinking on this? And were they right to get sort of slightly uppity about it?
I think the American biosecurity people were classically slightly hysterical about it. I mean, you can tell from what Ian has described that nothing very dangerous was done there, unless you're a ferret. So we've been put back 6 months.
Precautionary principle?
Well, yes, the precautionary principle is one would assume is being adopted by these two teams of scientists? And do we actually seriously believe that bioterrorists are going to read all these sequencing stuff in Nature or Science and think, oh, great, I'll just go along to a laboratory and make that stuff? Now, these experiments are done in an astonishingly sophisticated laboratories. I just don't for one minute believe that there was a bioterrorist capable of using that.
There must be easier things for a bioterrorist to get their hands on,
honest. Yes, precisely.
Smallpox, for example. Ian, what's the latest? They're going to publish this, these papers, both journals. It's all been allowed. I mean, there was some talk maybe of having restricted access to certain parts of the paper, but I think that's disappeared now.
Yeah, I mean, basically the idea that you would set up a mechanism whereby basically secret information, sensitive information from both of these papers could be circulated only to an approved list of scientists around the world.
It would immediately get leaked.
Yeah, I mean, it's unfeasible. You think about who actually does the work in a lot of labs. It's postdocs. You can't just isolate. You can't just identify, 400 people around the world who are the bigwigs and send it to them. You've got to pass it on to the guys who do the real work, while they're sat, overseeing these studies. So that was deemed impractical in the timeframe that you've got ahead. But I think that there is work going on within the US government now and the funders to try and find a mechanism for that in the future. And it will essentially mimic what is already done for classified research in the military. So that is on its way, but just not for these papers.
Robin, let's move on to a feature in this week's Observer. This is the 21st anniversary of the Bristol Children of the 90s study. Now, who are the Children of the 90s from Bristol? It's not a band, I'm assuming.
It does sound a bit sort of Sub-Oasis or something like that. But no, these children born to a cohort of about 14,500 women from the Avon region around Bristol, who were pregnant and the children they produced. So these women were studied all through pregnancy and the children have been studied all through their childhood, through adolescence, and now as they're reaching 21, some of them are becoming parents of their own. So we've got a sort of third cohort appearing. And these people will be studied and have been studied in great detail.
What kind of things?
You name it, they take it. They take everything, including the placenta. They even take their milk teeth. But you have to get that was the one the children balked at. So they had to get an official Bristol of the 90s project certificate from the tooth fairy before they could get this one taken away. They kept all this biological material. They fill in lots of administrative details, the health records, things like that. They're measured, weighed, you name it, every sort of physical measurement is taken, bone mass, DNA is taken, and also lots and lots of social surveys are done of them, attitudes to drink, drugs, that sort of thing. Now, very important in adolescence.
This obviously. Sort of long-term prospective study is incredibly powerful because you don't know what's going to happen to any of these people in terms of getting cancer or heart disease or any of these things, and therefore you can quite actively look for traits and genetic factors and lifestyle factors. What kinds of things have they produced in terms of scientific results?
One of the first things they showed was in the 1990s there was the Back to Sleep campaign where health workers were campaigning that children be put on the back so this would reduce cot deaths to stop them smothering. And there was a lot of fear that these children their motor development would be affected. And this study could survey that and showed very quickly that first motor development was affected. There was a decrease in motor development, but more importantly, that within 18 months, these cohorts that were put on the backs to sleep and they had reduced cot deaths, they'd caught up with the others. So it was a major player in getting cot deaths reduced in this country from about 1 in 500 births to about 1 in 2,000, as it is. There's other... sometimes the interesting thing about this study is, of course, that it's peculiarly British, and the British just like to keep records. We kept the best weather records in the world. We keep the best train records in the world. You name it, we write it down. And so this study, there's nothing like it in America. And Americans are queuing up to use the data. And they have used the data in one set of cases, which interestingly counterpoints with the British one. We used it to study drinks. What was your first reaction when you had your first drink? How much drink did you take to have an effect? And they found that the more drink you had to have to get an effect, the more likely you were to be a heavy drinker later in life. The others, the Americans, used it for cannabis, and they found that the more cannabis you had to do to get an effect, the less likely you were to be a heavy cannabis user. Basically, well, if it takes this amount of weed to get me stoned, I'm just not going to bother.
You're not going to
find something else. So there's kind of lots and lots of different kind of lovely kind of strands.
Is there any genetics involved?
Yes, there are. The genetics is coming in sort of a latter day kind of the
power of the genetics. Because it straddles the Human Genome Project this week.
Yes, and it kind of obviously cuts across the UK Biobank project. I mean, the thing about these projects is they keep getting launched every 10, 20 years is that you ask a lot of questions at the beginning, and then 10 years later you went, oh, bugger, I wish I'd asked that question. So when a whole set of new questions come up, you set up a new project and you start asking those questions again. So there will always be a need for these projects, but each one kind of builds like a little step on top of the next one.
So it's a bureaucratic masterpiece is what you were saying before, though, with all the writing down of all of the stuff.
Yes.
You assume now if someone was recruited, they could just have an app on their phone. They just record everything all day long. They get questions sent to them.
You can see it happening.
How long will these the children of the 90s be studied for?
Well, they're now studying the children of the 90s.
But they'll go on for an indefinite amount of time.
As long as they've got money, they'll keep on doing it, yeah.
I suppose it gets more and more valuable, the data set.
Each year you go on, the easier it is. The first year they published, the first 10 years produced one sort of ring binder of individual papers. That's in the first 10 years. Now each year produces a whole ring binder of papers just as the data accumulates.
I imagine the power of the study gets more and more effective as well.
Precisely.
Okay, well, let's finish up the news section with a story about fire. Particularly, when did humans start to use fire? Now, this is one of those old canards that we talk about all the time. You know, when was the invention of the wheel? When did we start heating things up to eat? These are all key milestones in the development of Homo sapiens, or the evolution of Homo sapiens. And there's a paper published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences last week, which identified a source of controlled fire in a cave in southern Africa that was more than a million years old. Now, the oldest fireplace, if you'll call it that, until now has been about 800,000 years in a site in Israel, but no one was entirely sure whether that was accidental forest fires or something, or on purpose. And the reason it's interesting, I suppose, well, there's two reasons. One is that the technique they used is quite interesting. They took a block of material, put it into epoxy resin, sliced it very thinly, looked at it through a microscope. So you can actually see the grains of ash and whatever else and bone in situ. You're not sort of messing around with the material. But the more interesting thing, I suppose one of the more interesting things about it is it can start to date when humans, or the ancestors of humans rather, modern humans, actually learnt to cook. And this is a hypothesis by a primatologist at Harvard University. He, Richard Wrangham, he thinks that cooking is what made humans' brains so big and our jaws small and our guts small. In other words, we could spend a short amount of time eating very energy-dense foods, get all the energy out of it very efficiently, rather than doing what our primate cousins do today, which is spending three quarters of their day chewing, you know, fibrous roots and leaves and things. And that allowed our brains to develop and created Homo sapiens. Interesting. Now, the proof of that would be ancient fireplaces around 2 million years old. He reckons that Homo erectus was the first of the big-brained human ancestors that came from Homo habilis because of this cooking thing. And, you know, it's a very seductive story because cooking is something that, you know, we sort of fetishize now even. Most of us do it, obviously, but it's one of these things which, you know, is an art form now. It's a universal human cultural thing. And so if they can find ancient fireplaces, 1.9 million years old, then Richard Wrangham's idea would be, let's say, proven. Okay, so far we've only got to a million years old and, you know, some way to go yet. But Robin, let me come to you on this. Yeah. You've got some thoughts on Richard Wrangham. He's an anthropologist, primatologist, who wrote a book a couple of years ago called Catching Fire, I think it was called, which is all about this hypothesis I've just talked about. Very seductive idea. What do you think of it?
It's initially seductive because I think, I do think he's got something to it. It is a unique human behaviour. You know, the primate cooks, you know, the animal.
Nothing else cooks.
Nothing else cooks. We're the only people that do it. could there be a connection? And yes, cooked food is much easier to digest, much easier to get the energy out of. And it's around the time that he hypothesizes that we got our big brains. And I can believe that. But like all authors of good ideas, he takes it too far. It's not the only thing that we started doing at that time. We started making tools. We pounded meat. We could dig things. We could get tubers up that are also easily digested. So there was a whole range of behaviours. Just to say that it's fire and only fire, I think, is taking it too far. And he also goes even further. He then suggests that, you know, we had these fires and, gosh, look at this. So we made these campfires and we gathered round them at night and it kept away the saber-toothed tigers. And we sat beside people and, well, we had nothing else to do but get on with each other because we sat round people at campfires. Crazy. I mean, just taking it at an absolutely ridiculous level.
Say it like you think.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think he's halfway there, but he's just exaggerated his case. I'm halfway there with him.
I'm just interested in what these guys were eating on the fire when they were going through the sections of what the material, the ash they found. Did they find any little cooked food?
They found bone. They found bits of bone. So I'm assuming it's whatever game was around. The people behind this study were led by a team from Boston University in Massachusetts. And they are very careful, if you read the paper, not to indicate that humans caused these, created these fires. They don't speculate who caused, how these fires started, how often the fires were happening, or what was being cooked, or even anything being cooked in them. They just found that by studying grains in 30 meters inside these caves, that you couldn't have had an accidental fire down there. Something had to take that stuff, the plant material and the bone material, into that place, and that there was a fire. That's all they can say. And this, in this beautiful economic way that scientific papers are. And then in the discussion, they sort of discuss the cooking hypothesis. And one of the researchers I spoke to, one of the authors, actually said, you know, until this evidence came along, I thought that Richard Wrangham was just talking nonsense. There was no evidence. He didn't say nonsense, but he said there was no evidence. He said, I've heard him talking about the cooking hypothesis before, but I've always thought, that sounds nice, but, you know, where's your evidence? And actually, there is evidence. And what they're saying is that if researchers use this technique in more places where there seem to be ashes and bones and things, they would maybe find older evidence for controlled fire. What they were cooking, they wouldn't speculate on that. And you really can't tell. There's absolutely no way of telling. And like good scientists, they didn't speculate on that, unfortunately.
The interesting thing, of course, is where the cave was, is in South Africa.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the way that South Africa is opening up and revealing itself into the study of human origins. It's just quite extraordinary. This is just another example of it.
We'll leave that there. Thank you very much, Robin and Ian. If you want to read more about any of those stories, go to guardian.co.uk/science. Gunther von Hagens is rightly famous, if not a little infamous, around the world for his Body Worlds exhibition. These present the human body in a dramatic and innovative way. In a process he calls plastination, he takes real human corpses and displays their muscles, their blood vessels, everything under their skin. In his latest work, von Hagens has applied the preservation and presentation techniques to the animal kingdom. The resulting exhibition at London's Natural History Museum is called Animals Inside Out. For Science Weekly, The Guardian's Lexi Topping met with the exhibition curator to find out more.
My name is Angelina Wiley. I'm the curator of the exhibition and the director of the Institute of Plastination in Heidelberg. And just by chance, I'm in addition Gunther von Hagens' wife.
That's an excellent coincidence. So if you could explain, just briefly, how does this process work?
In principle, it's pretty easy to understand. You need a vacuum, but to exchange the tissue water against the polymer, you need an intermediary step because the water would not be directly exchangeable with the silicone. And therefore, we need a process called dehydration by means of a volatile solvent. So we put the dissected specimen into an acetone bath, leave it to stay for several months. All the water would move out and the acetone would move in, and you have to exchange the bath to keep the concentration high enough. And this takes a couple of months until all the water is exchanged against acetone. And then you put it into a vacuum chamber and apply vacuum. And in vacuum, the acetone will evaporate very easily from the specimen, and this will draw the silicone into each individual cell where just the acetone evaporated from. And this is actually the core process of plastination, the so-called forced impregnation by vacuum. And that process takes a couple of weeks, depending on how big your specimen is. Then you take it out. You still have all the time necessary to put the specimen into a proper, nice, lifelike-looking posture, make sure that all anatomical structures are placed correctly. And then we cure it by means of a particular gas. And then it's cured, it's hard, and stays more or less forever.
I'm intrigued by this idea of these huge animals being in these massive baths. I mean, are they all there at the same time? What does that room look like?
Well, of course, it's not just a simple room. We have really huge facilities, and we used to have really, really many, many staff to work with it. For instance, on the elephant, that took us 3 years, more than 3 years, and about 30 staff members would work on the elephant on a given time, and we calculated it took 64,000 hours. So you may imagine this cannot be done in a simple room, so you really need big facilities, big containers, and even cranes to make them move, because you would not be able to move even an elephant's leg just by manpower. Here we are standing in front of a pretty big octopus, and it's really, really nice to look at, and we have placed it lifted on a glass plate, and underneath there's a mirror so that you can even see the animal's mouth. You look, this little piece there in the depth, this is where the octopus sucks in water and all the nutrition the octopus would need. And here the next one is already one of my greatest favorite. It is pretty big shark, and it shows just the arteries, only the arteries, no flesh is left behind, and that is only possible by a particular process that we apply. We inject a red polymer into the arteries, and while the polymer cures, it takes the shape of the arteries. And when the polymer is hard, we can dissolve the tissue away, and what remains is just the arterial system. And it looks so beautiful, like almost like a piece of art. And to me, they are also, although there's no tissue left, the rest representative of this creature, because they definitely suggest how fragile it is.
I've never seen anything like this. I mean, we're confronted with a life-sized, bright red shark here, all of its skin flayed off, its capillaries bright red, and it's a really spectacular thing. How does this shark get to this stage? How do you take off its skin? Do you need some kind of giant potato peeler?
Well, in this case, as I said before, we need to dissolve the tissue away, because otherwise, if you dissected the tissue away by means of a scalpel or a twinset, you would destroy quite a bit of the capillaries and the arteries. So this is what we want to maintain. So we need other means, and we use enzymes or bacteria or acids that will take the tissue away.
And is the shark suspended while this is happening to make sure there's no damage to it?
Absolutely. The polymer is pretty fragile, and we definitely need to make sure that there is no damage to the arteries, or that the animal is somehow kept in a strange position, which would make the specimen look ugly at the end.
So what makes you so excited about this exhibition? Why should people come and see it?
Well, first and foremost, the exhibition offers an opportunity to take a glimpse into a world that is otherwise locked away from you. There's never ever a chance where you can see with this great detail nicely dissected anatomical specimens, particularly these huge monumental specimens like the elephant or a giraffe. Even most veterinarians might not have had the chance to see the anatomy of an elephant or a giraffe in that detail. And secondly, it's really inspiring. to discover a different world. And I think it really sparks admiration, and it thus causes respect. You know, I want people to gain more respect. And if you, my hope is, and I'm sure it will turn out, because that's similar experience we had with other exhibitions, once you know about these wonderful beings in more detail, you gain appreciation. Mm-hmm. And that helps really people to protect their environment.
Animals Inside Out opens at the Natural History Museum in London on April the 6th, and it runs until September the 16th. For more information, just go to the museum's website, nhm.ac.uk. That's it for this edition of Science Weekly. We'll be back next week, and in the meanwhile, you can of course keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time on guardian.co.uk/science. Thank you also, by the way, to everyone who came to our special recording at the Royal Institution last week. That programme and the video associated with it is on our website. Just go to guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly if you want to watch or listen to that again. But for now, from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
During April, The Guardian's podcasts are partnering with audible.co.uk. Audible has over 60,000 digital audiobooks and are offering Guardian podcast listeners one for free. Visit guardian.co.uk/audible to find out more.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.